ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stone archways surround her and the ceiling domes high above. Filtered sunlight, it hits the stone tiles under her feet and there's the distant sound of water. And everyone around her is speaking in hushed tones. She's standing there, naked, in a towel, looking at strangers all around her. This isn't a weird dream. She's actually in a bathhouse, far from home.
And you went from one room into another. You take up all your clothes and they scrub you very, very strongly and then pour water on you and then you go into a hot area and then you go into a cold area. It's a great thing and I can imagine her loving it.
She looks at the other women around her and notices something about their skin that's very different from her own.
So what she notices is that they all have very smooth, beautiful skin because they haven't had smallpox, even though smallpox is rife in Western Europe, in North America as well.
How, she wonders, how are these women surviving a disease that has devastated people all around the world and back home?
The smallpox, so fatal and so general amongst us, is here entirely harmless by the invention of engrafting.
This aristocratic woman, whose name has largely slipped through the cracks of history, she saw a strange and confronting practice thousands of miles from home, and then had the audacity to bring it back to England. In fact, she dragged it straight to the heart of Western medicine. And the reaction?
She was vilified and she was criticised for being a bad mother and for bringing something that wasn't part of the medical establishment, bringing this folk practice to Britain.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of how a noblewoman's Eastern secret detonated moral panic, split the scientific establishment, and helped spark a medical revolution that would eventually wipe out one of the deadliest diseases on Earth. And no one saw it coming. All right, so I'm going to start by asking you a question that I did not think I would ask somebody. In the 18th century, how afraid would I have been of getting smallpox?
Oh, very afraid. Very afraid. I mean, within Europe, 1 in 20 people died of smallpox. And it was mainly a disease of children, so a lot of children died, so you'd be very worried for your children. And even if you survived it, you probably have the terrible pock marks that you might have seen pictures of all over your body, and you could well have other side effects. You could lose your sight or your eyesight could be very affected. There, people had quite a lot of mental health issues as a result, so it was a very serious illness.
So this is Jo Willett.
And for many, many years, I was a television drama and comedy producer here in the UK. But as I got closer to retirement, I thought I'd like to do something a little bit different. And so I started to write biographies. So far, I've written two, and they've been about women who live in the 18th century and who are a bit overlooked or people don't quite know who they are, etc.
And we will get to one of those women in a minute. But first, you need to understand the world this particular woman was living in. So before most vaccines, before most modern medicine, there was smallpox. And smallpox as a disease, it wasn't just deadly. It was terrifying.
What it would feel like was you would start with a very, very high fever. And then all over your body, but starting actually with your limbs and working up to the center of your body, you'd begin to get these really horrible, big, pussy spots. And then after a few days, they would erupt and the pus would come out. And you'd still have this very, very high fever. And most people would die around that time. But if you were lucky, then those would then turn into kind of hard pustules under your skin, a bit like having kind of dried peas or beans underneath your skin. And then in time, those would turn into the terrible scars that, you know, you've seen pictures of. So pretty horrible.
And so into this story, we have a woman known as Lady Mary. Who is she at this point in history?
Yes. Okay. So Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, she was born an aristocrat, born into the Pierpont family, and her mother had died very young, and she was the eldest of four siblings. She had taught herself with her sister to read. They'd gone into the family library and just taught themselves how to read. She was very, very intelligent.
By the time she was 16, Lady Mary had written two volumes of poetry, a short novel, and taught herself Latin. However, as she entered her 20s, her dad, being a respectable aristocratic dad, started husband shopping for her.
And negotiations began between her family and the Wortley Montagues for them to get married, but they kind of floundered. And so her father then wanted her to marry somebody else, an Irish peer with a fantastic name of Clotworthy Skeffington, which is a brilliant name, isn't it?
Amazing name. Incredible name.
I don't think it was the name that put her off. But anyway, she said she did not want to marry this man. But her father was adamant. And so eventually, even though she knew she wasn't in love by this time with Edward Wortley Montagu, she eloped with him. And so therefore she lost contact with her father and lost most of her money.
So she's run off and married Edward Wortley Montagu, who she's not really in love with and who her father does not approve of, which means she's now cut off from the family income stream. Not a great start to family life. Lady Mary, aged now around 20, she elopes, moves to London and becomes a popular socialite. And then word from home reaches her. Her only brother has died from smallpox.
I mean, obviously to lose anybody would be terrible, but she was absolutely devastated. And he was very young, but he was married with children and it just wiped him out totally.
And then a year or so later, Lady Mary also gets smallpox.
When she got it, they didn't think she was going to survive, but she did come through.
She didn't get away unscathed, though, did she?
No. She, of course, had these terrible scars all over her body, and also she lost her eyebrows and eyelashes, and her eyesight suffered. So ever after, she had what was called the Wortley stare, and she lost her looks, really.
And she soon lost her social standing as well, because when she had smallpox, Lady Mary, it seems, wrote some poems with a couple of her artist friends, and they were not meant to be published and widely read.
And she wrote a poem about having smallpox, but another of the poems she wrote was very against or seemed to be kind of parodying the royal family. And that the deal was at that time that if you were noble, your work wasn't published. But unfortunately, a very unscrupulous publisher published it. And so not only had she lost her looks and lost her chance to be at court, but also she'd become famous in the wrong way and the royal family weren't very keen on her. So, and Wortley was not very happy about this. So they were in quite a bad state by the time we get to sort of 1716 when she'd recovered from smallpox.
So she suffered a terrible loss with the loss of her brother. She herself has been afflicted by smallpox and it's robbed her of her looks. And then, on top of all of that, she's made herself an enemy of the royal court. At some point, Lady Mary and her husband, they make a huge move. Where do they go?
That's right. He is offered the chance to become the British ambassador to the Turkish court. So that would mean going off to modern-day Istanbul, Constantinople, and that kind of area, and representing Britain there. Normally, you'd go for about 5 years. And normally, just the man would go, and his family would stay in the UK. But Lady Mary, being Lady Mary, she wasn't going to miss this opportunity. She'd never been outside the UK, but she could see this was going to be a great adventure.
The decision is made. Lady Mary, her husband, Edward Wortley Montagu, and their young son, they make their way across Europe and all the way to what we know these days as Turkey.
She loved it there. They were in Constantinople. They lived in an area called Pera, and it's still there today. The British consulate is there today, which was their embassy. I mean, it's not the same building, but it's the same place. And it looks right over the Bosphorus. And you can see on the other side, you can see all the minarets and the mosques and things, the Blue Mosque and Hagia Sophia and things. And she described it in her letters as looking like a kind of a lady's dressing table with little pots on it of the different shapes. Throughout her trip, she wrote some amazing letters back home describing her experiences. And she really got into it. She learnt Turkish. And she made friends with the wife of the French ambassador, and they went exploring together, dressed up as men, because they wouldn't be allowed into these places as women.
Lady Mary is totally absorbed into this new city, its sights, its sounds, and its language too.
She was the first Western woman to have time alone, have dinners alone with the wives of the viziers and the emissaries, etc., the Turkish, important people. And because she could speak Turkish to them, that was absolutely invaluable, because she learned masses about their lives.
And there's also a point where she gets access to some, like, quite specific female-only spaces, and she sees and she learns things that most people don't really know about.
Yes, absolutely. So on the way there, in Sofia, which is in Bulgaria, I think now, but was again part of the Turkish Empire at the time, she went by herself to a Turkish bath. So she saw all these women, and of course, none of them had the pot marks on them. If she had been to something like that in Britain, everybody would have been, most people would have had the scarring.
She must be like asking people, like, why does your skin look so different from mine? What is it that you're doing here that we don't do in the West? Like, what is it that people tell her?
They really talk to her about the process of inoculation. She had taken with her in the party, or, Wortley, her husband, and she had taken with her a doctor called Dr. Maitland, a Scottish doctor, and he was very interested in inoculation. So he may well have told her something about it. I thought I might just read you one of her letters,
because
it does talk to you about it. Yeah. So this is a letter to her great friend Sarah Chiswell. She tried to persuade Sarah Chiswell to come with them to Turkey. She says, "Apropos of distempers, I'm going to tell you a thing that I'm sure will make you wish yourself here. The smallpox, so fatal and so general amongst us, is here entirely harmless by the invention of engrafting. There is a set of old women who make it their business to perform the operation. Every autumn, in the month of September, when the great heat is abated, people send to one another to know if any of their family has a mind to have the smallpox. And the old woman asks what veins you please to have opened. She immediately rips open that you offer to her with a large needle, which gives you no more pain than a common scratch, and puts into the vein as much venom as can lie upon the head of her needle, and after binds up the little wound with a hollow bit of shell. The children, or young people, play together all the rest of the day, and in perfect health till the eighth day. And in 8 days' time, they are as well as before their illness. I'm very well satisfied of the safety of the experiment, since I intend to try it on my dear little son. I am patriot enough to take pains to bring this useful invention into fashion in England."
And with that, Lady Mary decides to test it on her 3-year-old son. Now, just to be clear, this isn't like a mild parenting decision. She is about to deliberately infect a perfectly healthy child with smallpox, which to most people in England at the time sounds less like medicine and more like madness. And it's worse still because this whole practice is all very foreign. And she knows her husband would never agree. So she waits. She waits until he's away on business, safely out of veto range. And then she makes her move.
She waits until Wortley is gone. He's working elsewhere. And she and Dr. Maitland and another doctor who's there, they inoculate young Edward. In other words, they make cuts in his wrists and in his ankles, and they add a little bit of the smallpox pus, which they got from somebody who's got smallpox, into the wounds. And then they bind it with some cloth and a walnut shell, and then they wait for 8 days. He cries a little bit when they cut him, but he's fine. And he hardly has any spots at all. And by the time she writes to Wortley, he's running around and playing happily. And she knows that he will be protected against the smallpox for the rest of his life. By this time, she's also had their only daughter, Mary, who is just a babe in arms at that point. But she doesn't inoculate Mary. Not because Mary's too young, because actually babies are inoculated, but because Mary has a very, very good Armenian nurse who hasn't been inoculated. And Lady Mary knows that if she inoculates the baby will be infectious up until the time she's got over the scars. And she doesn't want to infect the Armenian nurse. So I say that because she's worked it out. She's a scientist, an early scientist, even though that word didn't exist in those days. But she has understood the process of inoculation, that you need to be careful.
Lady Mary throws the dice. She deliberately infects her son with a disease that back in England routinely kills children. And then they wait. 8 days. If this goes wrong, she's not just a bad mother. She's a murderer. But it doesn't go wrong. He barely develops symptoms. Within days, he's running around, he's playing, and just like that, he's protected for life. Her gamble has paid off. And so now, she wants the world to know, because she has seen something that it's extraordinary, that prevention can in fact be safer than a cure, that a controlled infection can stop a catastrophic one, that this very foreign Ottoman practice, it works. However, convincing England, that is another matter entirely. She's a woman promoting this foreign idea, telling the British medical establishment that they've missed something here.
The church was very against it because they felt it was against God. The medical establishment were very against it because they could see that it wasn't really medical. There was a lot of anti-Turkish feeling about it, about what do these people know? We're not like us. It's a folk practice. It's done in Turkey by little old women, often illiterate old women.
Do you think that it was the fact that it was women primarily pushing this that changed how receptive the public were, how receptive the press were to this treatment?
Oh, I'm sure, yes. Because as I say, there had been male papers to the Male Royal Society about it all, but no one had acted on it. And then here were these women coming in and saying, you really don't need all the medical stuff, and here we can do it. And look, you know, I think that was very threatening to the establishment, definitely.
Then a man enters the story, and his name was Edward Jenner.
Yes. So obviously he was a lot younger than Lady Mary. And as a young person, he had been quite sickly. And so in the second half of the 18th century, he went through this process of being inoculated, but having the whole bleeding and purging, first of all. And he absolutely hated that experience and probably nearly died as a result. So he then became a doctor, and he was determined to find a better way of protecting people against the smallpox.
And famously, Jenner noticed that milkmaids, women who milked cows, they never got smallpox.
This was a kind of known thing. And there were nursery rhymes and songs about how milkmaids always had beautiful skin because it wasn't pockmarked. And so he then was the first person to do a proper scientific experiment to see whether, rather than introducing the pus from a person, you could introduce it from a cow that had a related disease called cowpox, where they got spots. And sure enough, it worked really, really well. And he then wrote a paper on the Royal Society, and he described, because Latin for cow is vacca.
I think I know where you're going with this.
He said, I'm going to call this process vaccination, not inoculation, but vaccination. But of course, when we say vaccination, we think of like a needle, don't we, here? Mm. But early vaccination wasn't that at all. It was very like the process I've described to you of inoculation. Basically, it was just introducing a bit of cowpox into a cut on your body. And so for quite a long time, inoculation and vaccination coexisted, right through until sort of the middle of the 19th century, when it was decided to phase out inoculation and just to go with vaccination.
Lady Mary bringing this habit of inoculation that, you know, had been done for thousands of years in the East, bringing that to Western Europe, what do you think the impact of that was?
In the end, people accepted inoculation as something that was worth doing and meant you were protected from the smallpox. But the end is a long way from how it was initially for her. To begin with, she was vilified. She had to try to keep her own involvement in it very, very under the carpet. She didn't really want people to know that it was her. And she was criticized for being a bad mother and for bringing something that wasn't part of the medical establishment, bringing this folk practice to Britain. And her daughter described being in the carriage with her mother, going off to inoculate whole households against this disease, and people jeering the carriage as they went by. And then they got out giving kind of significant shrugs to each other about, I can't believe she's arrived.
Jeanette, when we talk about vaccinations being invented, Edward Jenner, understandably, is credited with inventing vaccinations as we understand them today. But I think that history, it misses some other key dominoes that needed to fall, including the role of Lady Mary, the role of those women in that bathhouse in Turkey.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes. And actually, you could say beyond that, because the Turks, they weren't the people who invented inoculation. Actually, the Chinese had invented the inoculation probably in about the 12th century, and they used to do it up their nose. They would take stuff from their nose. But then it came to Turkey, and then, you know, it gradually went westwards.
Smallpox was one of the deadliest diseases known to humans. Over thousands of years, it killed hundreds of millions of people. And that practice of inoculation that was used all throughout Asia and some parts of Africa, it was Lady Mary Wortley Montagu that brought it to Europe in 1721. It would take years, all the way up until 1980, but eventually smallpox was declared officially eradicated. And Lady Mary is a small, yet incredibly consequential part of that story.
And I'd like to see more statues to her. I'd like to see more attention focused on her, without taking it away from Jenner. But I do think her story is an extraordinary story, and it's not really very well known. I just think she's the most wonderful character. She's so modern, she's so feisty, and she's so interesting. And of course, this isn't just, I mean, I think she would say that the inoculation is an incredible part of her life, but her whole life she was breaking down barriers and challenging things and looking at things in different ways. I think she's a great woman for today.
Jo, you are an absolute delight. I cannot thank you enough for giving us your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Oh, that's good. Lovely.
That is author Jo Willett. This episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf. The sound engineer was Ross Richardson. No One Saw It Coming is made on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. And as always, if you've got a story you want us to cover, all you need to do is let us know at noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. I'm Mark Fennell. I'll be back with a brand new episode next week. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.